Ladies and gentlemen, live from the West Coast, it's time for Ring Talk Live Worldwide. Your inside look into combat sports.
Ring Talk Live Worldwide, brought to you by the WBC, the World Boxing Council.
It is absolutely necessary that we all get together. We work together. We respect each other. We like and love each other.
And now, the host of the longest-running fight show in radio and internet history.
I'm getting tired of people running from me in the ring. Mike Tyson, Holyfield, you a bunch of bums. Stand up and be a man and fight a real fighter.
Pedro Fernandez.
Damas y caballeros, bienvenidos, ladies and gentlemen. Emanating, coming at you from the multi-million dollar Sports Byline Studios. Check it. This is WBC Boxing TV and Ring Talk Live Worldwide. Often imitated but never duplicated, 37, make that 38 plus years now of being on top. My name is Pedro Fernandez. I am the undisputed heavyweight champion of the radio race course, having defended the title, make that 38 years. So, supposedly, you know, that and the fact that I box a little bit, I'm supposed to know something about boxing, but I've always found out that the average boxing fan blows my mind. So, here's a chance for the average boxing fan to blow my mind. I will open up the toll-free phone line right here at the top of the hour. 1-800-878-PLAY. That's 1-800-878-7529. Of course, there's also the guilt-free no-commitment text line. You can text us here in the studio, as a lot of people did the last hour. I said that I blasted. I didn't blast you, Kurt Stevenson. I wouldn't call that a blast. If I put him on blast, you'd be knowing it. But was I impressed with his performance last night? Maybe if I was watching a guy spar. I mean, it was a good sparring session, but he never went for the kill. And, of course, we talked about this before. When you're a good fighter and you have to prove that you're a great fighter, or you want to prove that you're a great fighter, you need to gamble on a cage. And, of course, Ray Leonard talked about that in depth. The difference between a good fighter and a great fighter is the ability and the willingness to gamble. Shakur doesn't look like he's willing to gamble. Not in my mind. You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide and WBC Boxing TV. We'll hear from Larry Merchant this hour. Of course, HBO's Greatest Hits with Larry Merchant. That and more on Ring Talk Live Worldwide and WBC Boxing TV.
Something else to watch. Two men at the highest level battle, and one may be favored over the other, but you never know what's going to happen. And that's why boxing is the way it is.
Ring Talk Live Worldwide is brought to you by the World Boxing Council, the WBC.
The new ballad from Lenny Williams, My Man, of course, done it on his own, man. Left Tower of Power, of course, became a superstar. Platinum recording artist, all that kind of good stuff. Bottom line is, he's still my friend. I can still call him on the phone. In fact, there's a picture I put up on my Facebook page last week of himself, of Lenny Williams, myself, Jeffrey Traeger, the legendary Northern California rock music promoter, and, of course, the late Rick Stevens. Donald Stevens is when he was born, of course. Rick Stevens, the guy that sings You're Still a Young Man and Down to the Nightclub. Bottom line is, Rick has left us, but the other three, the other three of us are still rocking and rolling, no doubt about that. Now, Jermell Charlo, of course, the WBC 160-pound champion, not my favorite guy. Why? Because he keeps fighting guys that are, when I say, you know, guys that he's going to beat. In other words, there's never any question mark as far as his opponents are concerned. And Juan Macias Mancilla Montiel was stopped in two rounds by Jaime Munguia, who will be in action soon. But, you know, what does that say to him? If the guy was stopped in two rounds by Jaime Munguia, he's 22-4. He's been stopped the one time, of course, 22 KOs with 22 fights. He's supposedly a big puncher. He can knock people out with one punch, but he hasn't knocked people out at the upper echelon of boxing. Of course, he's going to take on Charlo. Before that, he beat James Kirkland. Well, Kirkland hadn't fought since, like, Richard Nixon was president. Kirkland was, like, 34-2, but he had been off a long time. That was in 2020. Kirkland was on the comeback trail. As I look down the rest of his resume, the only one that stands out there is Jaime Munguia. And before he fought Munguia, he fought a guy by the name of, get this, Johnny. He doesn't know how to spell his name, J-H-O-N-Y. Of course, some Mexican family, some Latino family spelled Johnny that way, but I just thought it was a misspelling from the get-go. Remember Johnny Gonzalez? Remember him? Anyway, Johnny, Freddy, and they spell Freddy, F-R-E-D-Y. So evidently, this family wasn't big on spelling. Johnny Freddie Navarrete Montano beat this guy, Montiel, with a split decision. That was in 2016. So he was 28-8 coming in, so he should have been the opponent. Bottom line is, he isn't supposed to win he didn't win the fights he was supposed to. So in other words, he's not going to win the fight he's not supposed to next week against Charlo. Charlo, of course, lunch meat, I think, for Canelo Alvarez. He steps up to 168. He's a 160-pounder with no doubt about that. 31 fights, but 31 expected endings. I mean, there's not a fight where you said, you know, who's Charlo going to fight tonight? Oh, my God, is he going to win? Is he going to lose? Well, we never know because, I mean, we always know because of the fact that he fights such a lower echelon of fighters. I mean, he could step up. He talks about Canelo. You heard Eddie Croft say that now, number one. He talks about Canelo, you know, I don't need Canelo and then to fulfill my legacy. And then you hear him say, well, I'll fight Canelo, but I want Canelo to come to 160 pounds. Canelo is the 168-pound champion last time I looked. Why would he want to fight at 160 pounds? Why would you want to cut off an arm to go down to 160 after being the champion at 168? You wouldn't, okay? Guys that have made the decision to cut weight at the tail end of their career, especially guys like Ray Leonard. Remember, when Ray Leonard fought Macho Camacho, promoter Mike Akery, may he rest in peace. He passed away in the last 6 or 7 months. But Mike Akery had Hector Camacho and Sugar Ray Leonard weigh in the morning of the fight. Ray was out-negotiated. He was out-negotiated by Mike Akery. In fact, he threw this weigh-in clause into the contract where Ray had to weigh 160 pounds that morning. And Ray hadn't been 160 pounds, I think, in about 4 or 5 years. So it was a strain to make the weight. He didn't make the weight. He had a bad Achilles tendon going in. Of course, he got lit up like a White House Christmas tree. And Hector Camacho was a winner that day. But Hector Camacho, of course, his son, going to fight Julio Cesar Chavez this week in an exhibition. Of course, we heard from Oscar Valdez in hour number one talking about the legacy of the greatest fighter of all time when it comes to Mexico, Julio Cesar Chavez Sr. I think that without a doubt, I mean, nobody's been able to duplicate what he did. And people accuse him of fighting taxi cab drivers. I remember that, you know, Greg Hogan did, yeah, he fought a whole lot of they were some pretty good taxi cab drivers because he beat them all. And then, of course, he beat Greg Hogan, lit him up in front of like 100,000 people down there in Mexico. But Greg was a perfect foil. He was a perfect foil. He played the bad guy perfectly. That was almost like wrestling, where you have the good guy and the bad guy, or the heel and the good guy, or the heel and the baby face. Because without a doubt, Chavez, the hometown guy, was a baby face. He was a baby face, going in, no doubt about it. He was the baby face. And Hogan was this guy from America that was, you know, a white guy with didn't appreciate Mexicans, called him, you know, all of Julio's opponents cab drivers, this and that. He got lit up the White House like the White House Christmas tree for that, no doubt about that. But at the end of the day, they drew 100,000 people, and he did what he was supposed to do. That's right. Hogan was supposed to draw people, and he drew people, no doubt about that. Now, they're talking about Charlo fighting Gennady Golovkin after this. I guess he's got to. I mean, Golovkin's like 95 years old now. I think it's like he's about 39. But he's old. Older than dirt, and of course he's been in a lot of tough fights, and as of late, he's looked good physically, I mean, beautifully, but then again, you gotta figure out these guys that he's fighting are made to, make him look good. Now, that's not saying a boxing's choreographed, but to an extent, with Triple G, they're trying to build him up again, make him a superstar, make him the super attraction, so maybe we can go a third time with Canelo. Of course, that would be at 168. He doesn't want to fight at 168, but he will for the money. There's no doubt about that. And of course, this 160-pound fight with Charlo. Now, Charlo and him at 168, at 160 would be a decent fight. Who wins at that fight? Who knows? Even though Golovkin's long in the tooth, Triple G, even though he's long in the tooth, I think he's got enough pop, enough zip, enough stamina, and enough boxing guys to beat Charlo. Much like, I want to think of Roberto Duran and Davey Moore back in 1983. Was it 1983? It was 1983. I think it was. Of course, Duran and Moore. Duran was the up and comer, basically moving up in weight. By that, he was 147 pounder. Before that, of course, he had lost to Sugar Ray Leonard in the No Moss fight. His career was thought to be over. He moved up to 154. He beats Pepino Cuevas, as expected, down there at the LA Sports Arena in January of 1983. And then, of course, he steps into the Garden, Madison Square Garden, to fight Davey Moore, who's from New York City. That was in June of 1983. And, of course, Moore went into that fight about a 3.5, maybe a 4-1 favorite. I mean, Moore looked down at the ground like he looked at Duran. He looked down at the ground. He almost spit at the ground before the fight. Well, he wasn't thinking that after the first round, especially the second round when Duran caught him with that mean right hand. They both threw right hands. Duran's landed first. And guess what? That was the end of the night for Davey Moore. Davey said he tried to say, oh, I sort of got thumbed, this and that. Man, you got your you know what kick. There's no doubt about that. Now, when I think about it, Golovkin, of course, at 160 pounds, him doing that kind of licking on Mr. Charlo, I think that's going to happen. Anyway, at 21 minutes past the hour, we're going to break, and of course, we'll be going to January of 2020 and bringing the retired HBO godfather, Larry Murch, of course, talking about HBO's greatest hits. The highlight moments of his career with HBO will go into that in depth. Of course, the godfather not able to appear this week because of the fact the godmother, Patricia Stitch Merchant, is not feeling well. And, you know, I'm not a big prayers guy, but I always pray for her, and I wish her the very best. She was always sweet to me. I mean, when Larry was gruff with me when I was a kid, and I want to say when I was a kid, but when Larry was gruff with me 35, 40 years ago, she wasn't. I mean, she was always super nice to me. Of course, a television star in her own right in different sitcoms and drama series and things like that, the 70s, 80s, and 90s, that was Patricia Stitt Merchant. And, of course, she is sick right now, so we wish her the very best as far as her recoveries are concerned. Now, June 12th, UFC was rocking and rolling. I will mention the UFC just for a second. Of course, the UFC main event, Israel Adesanya decision defeated Marvin Vettori, unanimous nod across the board, 50-45. In other words, it was a rematch, and it was a mismatch to boot. Why they did it a second time, I just don't know. Now, the Brandon Figueroa won the flyweight championship, 125-pound championship, when he beat Davison Figueroa. He's got a big long name, but that's the way it sounds. Anyway, a rear naked choke in round number three. And the reason why I bring that up is that Brandon Moreno is the first born Mexican to win the UFC title. So now Dana White, who I am not a fan of course, I consider Dana the pimp. And the reason why I say that is that the fighters aren't making any money. I mean, you know, I try to tell you, when I was a cop in San Francisco, I ran into a lot of pimps, okay, guys that had girls working for them. If they told the girl, guess what, you're going to do a favor for $100, and I'm only going to give you $8 to $10, maybe $12, they would all be on the first bus to Denver, okay, out of town, they'd be gone. But in the UFC, if Dana tells them, I'm going to give you $8 to $12 on the dollar, they got to take it or walk. 90% of the time, they take it, thus, they end up losing. Next up, the retired HBO godfather and HBO's greatest hits, Larry Merchant and more on Ring Talk Live Worldwide and WBC Boxing TV.
Ring Talk Live Worldwide is brought to you by the World Boxing Council, the WBC.
I am a little more impressed with you.
Don't waste your time.
More of Ring Talk with Pedro Fernandez.
Go put your coat on, honey. This is getting good.
You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. You're inside looking at the world of boxing and MMA. Yesterday, my current guest, Larry Merchant, told me he was being interviewed by somebody who was looking into the history of HBO. You know, you and I haven't talked about HBO. I mean, the fact that when HBO sort of retired and went off the air as far as boxing was concerned, that was a bit sad. But outside of that, we haven't talked really extensively about your time at HBO. What were the highlights and the lowlights? If you go through it, like from 78 on, right? From 78 is when you started, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, to me, they were just highlights and bigger highlights. Whether it turned out well or not, if you're out there analyzing and telling stories and critiquing, there are some nights when you missed the story.
Mm-hmm.
You missed the central story of the fight. That happens, and that's why, just like you have three officials, and you hope that at least two of them get a result right, you have three announcers, or at least we did, and you hope that two of them got it right, and most usually we did. But there were higher highlights. We covered so many great fights from Sugar Ray Leonard and Hearns and Hagler in the 80s, and then the heavyweights in the late 80s and early 90s. I always think of my timeline regarding Mike Tyson,
mm-hmm.
And our experiences together, and his leaving HBO because he didn't particularly want me to announce his fights. But You know, I don't think of it in those terms. You know, what I think of is one of the questions I'm often asked is what my best interviews were. Mm-hmm. And most people are thinking of the incident with Floyd Mayweather, but to me,
not me,
the Buster Douglas Mike Tyson fight, which was of course this enormous upset, was some kind of serious moment for me as a broadcaster. I had originally come from print journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Because Buster Douglas, after that fight, was so tied up emotionally, having won the heavyweight championship of the world, having maybe resolved some issues with his father, who was a tough middleweight in his time, not a championship caliber fighter, but a tough guy. And Buster was raised in his gym, and Buster wasn't exactly a tough guy, and he tried other sports until he came back to boxing. And then the fact that his mother had died a few weeks before. So all these entanglements, emotional history came to play, and when I went to interview Buster Douglas, he couldn't talk. He was so wound up emotionally. And I heard a voice in my head saying, "This is show and tell, Larry. Just let's show this. We do these interviews in part to show who these fighters are as human beings. We do these interviews to answer some questions and question some answers." And he couldn't talk, and he stepped back, and his handlers took him, and they were whispering to him, "Let's go back to the dressing room, let's go." And but he wanted to tell his story, and it took him maybe 20 or 30 seconds, which is a lifetime in television seconds, to gather himself to tell the story he wanted to tell about the fight and what it all meant to him. To me, that was my suddenly becoming a professional at this craft, because I understood that the camera focusing on this guy who had just pulled off the upset of the century, or so we thought at the time, and all of his emotional cords being rung, that was real television. It didn't need a question. But then he stepped forward and we talked about all of these things. And to me, that was a primal moment. And there were other lessons that I learned from what I did across the years.
You know, when I think of Buster Douglas, I think of Haseem Rahman and most recently Andy Ruiz, guys that pulled off this huge upset and then just couldn't handle it emotionally.
Well, they couldn't handle it afterwards. Certainly Buster Douglas couldn't. He put on
100 pounds.
15 pounds or so for his fight with Holyfield,
yeah,
and didn't seem to care very much. And he didn't. He didn't love boxing. In that moment, because of his mom's death, because of his differences with his father, and because he was fighting for the heavyweight championship, it was a way of redeeming his whole life. And those are the stories we try to tell. But, yeah, you know, fighters are human beings, and some of them handle things differently than others. I have to remind myself that the guy I'm trying to interview was just getting punched for an hour. So, and just learning to do my homework before the events so that I will have enough of information in my head to feel that I could say certain things.
I think it was 1982, and I always, Harold used to tell me this, the late Harold Letterman, your broadcast partner, of course, the HBO boxing judge, that voice, Harold's voice. Well, Jim, bottom line is, Harold told me the best fight that he ever called, he thought, with you guys, was the Gomez-Pintor fight, Wilfredo Gomez and Lupe Pintor, back in 1982. Of course, Pintor ascending from 118 pounds to 122 pounds. He had beaten the former bantamweight great Carlos Zarate at 118, moved up to 122, and Gomez just, they went back and forth. Gomez finally won, but what a battle of wills.
Yeah, and that was the next fight we did after the fight in Miami. I'm trying to think of the names of the fighters. They fought at least one rematch. The great fighter from Nicaragua.
Alexis Arguello and Aaron Pryor.
Right. I mean, how good was that? So we were in a run in those days of having a lot of big fights, which sometimes means an outstanding fighter is in a mismatch because there just aren't enough guys around to compete with him, or two really good fighters just throwing down.
Yeah, you know, we brought up Alexis Arguello there. Of course, death in 2009, 2008, still questionable whether he shot himself or somebody killed him. He was so emotionally depressed that he came on his show and talked about death and things like that. And I tried to go down to Nicaragua and straighten him out, and he finally went into rehab, this and that. But both he and Pryor were smoking crack together in Miami. When he told me that story, I almost wanted to cry. He was telling me the story in Managua, Nicaragua, sitting in his backyard. And he goes, yeah, Aaron and I were smoking crack together in Miami. And I say to myself, what could send a man in that direction? You know, I was just blown away by that. And Alexis was never the same, ever. He was an emotionally tender man. And I think that first fight with Pryor just broke him for the rest of his life.
Well, how many tens of thousands of people are dying in America of opioids every year?
Every day.
That may not be the same as trying to achieve a high. It's trying to avoid a low and then getting so low you never return. But crack was a thing and it affected all of society, and it shouldn't surprise us that some fighters were affected by it as well.
Speaking of this opioid thing, I mean, the fact that you can get, that you were able to get these pills, I mean, they were willing to give them to me left and right. I never took a one in my life. I never took a one, but they gave me a couple of pain pills one time for my dentistry and for my back and this and that. And that's what they tell me. Just take this. Godfather, man, these are doctors pushing stuff on you, so you get the assumption that it's good, you know what I'm saying? And then you find out after a week you're hooked.
You know, I've read many stories about this phenomenon, and it's sad. It's happened to a lot of average people who have lost their jobs in the changing job market of modern times and have no place to go and are depressed because of how it can break up families, and they look to avoid the pain that they're experiencing. I don't know that the government has done enough to limit that, but obviously there are other solutions that prevail. But let's say you've lived in a town in Ohio,
yeah,
and had manufacturing there for generations, and your family and friends are all there, and suddenly,
yeah, but
jobs are gone.
But Godfather, that shouldn't turn you into a heroin addict. Anyway, say hello to the God Mama for me. It is January 12, 2020. I love you, and we'll talk real soon.
Keep the faith, Pedro.
The Hall of Famer, the one, the only, the Godfather, retired HBO Godfather, Larry Merchant in the house. Thank you so much, Godfather. This is Ring Talk, live worldwide. Together,
Now, more of Ring Talk with Pedro Fernandez, brought to you by the WBC, the World Boxing Council, right here on Sports Byline.
Okay, that's not Benny King, and it's not the Drifters. It's Muhammad Ali when he was Cassius Clay. Back in 1963, he charted with that. I kid you not. Muhammad Ali and Stand By Me singing. You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide and WBC Boxing TV. One of the biggest, well, obviously, the COVID-19 crisis has hit this country and the world like nothing we've ever seen in the past. Maybe the plague of a couple hundred years ago. Bottom line is, in San Francisco, many of my fellow Latinos were scared to get tested. Then they were scared to get the vaccine. But the man that's put both the testing and the vaccine together free of charge in the Mission District is none other than Mr. Roberto Hernandez himself. Roberto, how's life treating you?
Man, I'm blessed, brother. I'm alive. I've survived the pandemic. You know, that's a blessing. You know, people don't realize, you know, until this pandemic, how vulnerable we are, right? I mean, a simple little, you know, somebody breathing in front of you that's got COVID can kill you.
Yeah.
So I'm good. How you doing, Pedro?
You know, Roberto Hernandez, our guest, of course, Mission District activist. I hope to be able to vote for him in a citywide election in the near future. But, you know, you sort of took the phobia out of people testing. You offered the free testing of the BART station at 24th and Mission. My producer went out there and got tested, and then he went and got the vaccine at 24th and Cap. So you took care of him. He didn't have health insurance. I want to thank you for that. That was so cool.
Yeah, well, you know, from the very beginning, you know, I'll tell you the story. I knew about the virus. Way before anybody knew, I sat on the board of directors for the Mission Neighborhood Health Center back in the 80s. And, of course, you know, being on the board, I met a lot of doctors and scientists. So fast forward, in December of 2019, I get a call from a Dr. Sacchetti, who is now retired, but renowned, known for pediatrics. And we became very good friends. She always referred to me as a kid because she was older than me. And she said, "Hey, kid, you still up for learning?" I said, "Yeah," because I would always ask her, "Hey, what about this? What about that?" And she'd give me books and she'd send me seminars. And so I learned a lot about health in the 80s. And so here I am, you know, on a phone call with her. And she goes, "Hey," and she's always short on the phone. She goes, "Hey, you free on Saturday?" I go, "Yeah, what's up?" She goes, "Well, jump on a call. You're going to learn about something that's going to affect the whole world." And I was like, and she hung up. I jumped on this call, and there was 33 doctors and scientists on the call. And for over an hour, I listened to, wow, just like, I was like with my mouth open the whole time, hardly breathing. Near the end of the call, I said, you know, I introduced myself and I said, you know, "Thank you, Dr. Sacchetti, for inviting me to the call. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. I have a couple questions. One," I said, "does our government know about it?" And they go, "Oh, yeah." I said, "So what's the plan the government has?" And one doctor very sarcastically said, "Well, who's your president?" And that was the end of the conversation. So having had that information, I began to talk to people about the coronavirus. And as you can imagine, you know, the majority of people that I talked to said, yeah. And it's like one of them said, "There you go again." You know, and I'm good with that. I never take anything anybody says personal. And so, but sure enough, when the virus hit, guess what? Everybody and their mama's calling me. So I have had a long-standing relationship with UCSF, not only because of the Mission Neighborhood Health Center, but because at the annual Carnival in San Francisco, we have a health pavilion that I created back in the days when, if you remember, the AIDS epidemic.
Sure.
So I reached out to them back then, and I said, "Hey, I'd like to do AIDS testing at Carnival." And I also reached out to the Department of Public Health, and we had a meeting, and they looked at me like I was crazy. And so that's okay. But I insisted, and you know me better long enough, when I get on a horse, I don't get off the horse until we ride. And so sure enough, I got them to come out and do testing both days. And guess what? What they thought, you know, they really thought people would not take an AIDS test. Simple as that. I can't tell you anything more.
Well, you know, what I find is funny is that people are coming to me, Latino people are coming to me, people, white people, I mean, people of all ethnic groups are coming to me like, Pedro, if I take the vaccine, I won't be able to have kids. One lady said to me, I think it'll turn me gay. And I mean, how do I respond to that? You're the expert. How do you respond to that?
So let me finish telling you the AIDS thing story.
Okay.
So on the second day of the testing, they called me up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They summoned me to where they were doing the testing and said, Roberto, we ran out of, needles and we can't do any more testing. And there's a line around the block. And I said, it's okay. We just take everybody's name and number and we'll set up an appointment for them.
Yeah.
Done. Fast forward, you know, so UCSF knew that had some street health cred. And so reached out to them about this COVID, and I found out that they were willing to do a study. So in the Mission District around Garfield Park, 25th and Harrison, which I did not know, we have the highest density in terms of people living in two census tracts. So they selected those two census tracts, which over 4,000 people live in that, just those two census tracts.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did, in April, we tested over 4,000 people. Pedro, the majority of the people who tested positive were Latinos. And I couldn't believe it. And I went back to UCSF. I said, why? Can we study in the study? Why? Right? So we went back to everybody that tested positive. And sure enough, found out that they did not shelter in place because they had to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
There were janitors, people working in the food industry, at grocery shops, et cetera, et cetera. And we found out that the employers weren't providing them with protective gear. So I went to the mayor immediately and said, first I went to the Department of Public Health and said, we need to test everybody in the neighborhood. And they listened. They said, okay, but they never did nothing about it. Weeks went by and finally called the mayor and I said, hey, I'm not getting any response. We have the highest rate, blah, blah, blah. At some point at San Francisco General Hospital, people were dying, and the more than 50% of those in the hospital being treated for COVID were Latinos, but yet we're only 15% of the population. So I used that data, went back to the mayor, and that's when I said, you know what, forget the Department of Public Health. We'll do our own testing. You know, and we created the Latino Task Force, and I got to thank them. And through the health committee we created, we were able to do testing at 24th and Mission, and then we did testing in front of the Mission Food Hub at 701 Alabama Street. And then the next challenge was to get people to get tested, you know. And, Matt, you would not believe what I heard about, if I get tested, you know, I mean, insane. It's just simple. It's up your nose, you blow. You know, you put stuff up your nose before, you know, whether it be Vicks vapor or cocaine. I said, come on, everybody got to get tested. So everybody, we started getting people tested, and it was the best thing we could have done to prevent people from dying. And then when the vaccine came out, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, people were, like, desperate to get the vaccine across the country. Except those were, you know, who were listening to Trump, of course. And so, but, you know, Latinos haven't gotten tested at the level that they should. So, again, went back to the mayor with the Latino Task Force and the health committee and said, hey, we need to get the virus
vaccine
shots in our neighborhood, just like we did with the testing. And by now they figured out it works, right? So it was a no-brainer, and we opened up at 24th and Cap. Then we went to the Labor's Union Hall at 18th and Shotwell, and then of course in front of Mr. Buddha. The problem is that, you know, I get a call from Dr. Colfax saying, hey, you know, Latinos are not getting, the vaccine at the rate that the rest of the ethnic groups and populations in the city. And he says, do you know why? I said, no, I don't know why. And he said, but you know what? I'll find out. And so I did focus groups. I got Spanish speaking only, 20 of them. And then I did 20 English only speaking Latinos. And then I did the 16 to 25 year old Latinos. And Pedro, oh my God, you mentioned just a few things. I thought, wow, I heard I can't get pregnant. I won't be able to breastfeed my child. My DNA will change. They're gonna put a chip inside my body.
The chip.
Oh, yeah. Insane. Right? And so I listened to, and I went back and reported all this to the director of the Department of Public Health. And so we brainstormed a little bit more. And he goes, well, where are they getting that information? I said, okay, well, let me go back and I can get information. So we went back and did another round of, you know, focus groups. And sure enough, people were getting their information from social media. And so I said, everybody, okay, pull your phones out. Go to where you got your information from. Once everybody had that, I said, okay, now search the source. None of them knew how to do that, but I know how to do it. So I taught them all how to search the source. And sure enough, Pedro, every single one that traced the source, it was all fake news.
So it tells
me something, that there's somebody out there sabotaging, you know, the vaccine in this country to, you know, either kill people or let people die. I don't know, but
well, here's a $64,000 question, Mr. Hernandez. Roberto Hernandez, Mission District activist here in the city by the Bay, San Francisco, California, is my guest. Trump got the vaccine. His entire family got the vaccine. Why wouldn't the people that follow him like they do, why don't they realize he got the vaccine? Maybe they should too.
Yeah, but you know, you gotta understand that we have like elderly women who are abuelitas, grandmas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they're let's just talk about that population, that sector for a minute. You know, some of them are religious. Some of them believe in natural healing remedies, you know, they made back home. And so to say, hey, you want a vaccine and you don't know what's in that vaccine, right, is like, no, they ain't going to do it. So one of the things that we've done is we've been having, it's called Cafecito con la Doctora. So we have a doctor that's volunteering her time, and she'll sit there and have coffee with 10 elderly women, and we pay for their breakfast, and they feel comfortable. And why? Because one of the things I ask in those focus groups, well, who influences you, right? If this is fake news, who influences you? And they said, oh, the teacher, the doctor, and the priest. So I started with the doctor, and let me tell you, man, it's working. The doctor sits there and has breakfast with them, and they can ask, and she'll answer any and every question that they have. And then at the end, she gives them the information of what actually is in the vaccine, and it's working. But it's not fast enough. I need about another 100 doctors to volunteer to do that.
Okay, let's talk about your latest project, the Mission Food Hub. I mean, how many people you feed a month there, or a week? 9,000, 10,000?
So we're providing groceries to 9,000 families a week. And actually, I started this, you know, over a year ago out of my house. I got a call from an elderly woman who told me she lost her job of 33 years working in a restaurant. And she was getting paid cash. And she didn't call for unemployment, Social Security, nothing. I almost was in tears, Pedro. That was criminal what that employer did. Not paying her into her benefits. And so I asked her, what's the one thing that I could help you with? And she explained to me, well, so I have my daughter living with me. My son-in-law passed away over a year ago, and she has 5 children, and I'm the sole supporter of the 6 of us. And she goes, and we only have 1 day left with the food. So I went and bought her groceries. Okay. But the phone kept ringing, and similar stories.
You know what, Roberto, I'm running up on a hard break. Give me a website. You got a website down there?
Yeah, missionfood.org.
Missionfood.org?
Yeah.
The hero, my champion, Roberto Hernandez. I hope to see you being mayor of San Francisco someday, my brother. You know I love you.
Love you, too. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Roberto on Ring Talk Live Worldwide and WBC Boxing TV. You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. Check it, your inside look into the world of boxing, MMA. Next week, Charlo's the winner. Jermell Charlo is going to take care of Juan Macias Montiel. Whether Montiel can punch or not, doesn't matter. Charlo's going to beat him. Nanoa Inoue is going to take on Michael Dasomarinas. Like Eddie Croft said, I think Inoue is going to win here. I think Inoue will win going away. Teofimo Lopez, although I think 118 pounds is not his best weight. I think Eddie was right. 112, maybe 115 pounds was his prime. Of course, June 19th, as well, the 135-pound world champion. I'm talking about Teofimo Lopez, of course, coming to you on Fight In Demand pay-per-view. That'll come to you from Miami, Florida. Teofimo is going to light George Kambosos up like the White House Christmas tree. I mean, Kambosos beat Leo Selby. He handily beat Leo Selby. Eddie sort of tried to poo-poo that, but I thought he handily beat Leo Selby in his last fight. But I don't think he's ready for prime time in Teofimo Lopez, no doubt about that. You've been tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide and WBC Boxing TV. My name is Pedro Fernandez. I thank you so much for tuning in. I want to thank my guests. Of course, the retired HBO godfather, Larry Merchant. May his wife get better real soon. I'm talking about Patricia Stitch Merchant, a.k.a. the godmother. May she get well real fast. Get well, princess. Anyway, I want to thank Roberto Hernandez, of course, of the Mission District. When I say Roberto and the Mission District, like hand in hand, sort of like Cesar Chavez and the farm workers, or Julio Cesar Chavez Sr. and boxing. Speaking of Julio Cesar Chavez Sr., he'll be in an exhibition this week with Hector Camacho Jr., and that will be on pay-per-view as well. So June 19th, lots of boxing on television and pay-per-view. Until next time, keep your hands up, keep your chin down, but most importantly, keep your butt off the canvas of life. I thank you so much for tuning in to WBC Boxing TV and Ring Talk Live Worldwide. My name is Pedro Fernandez. Thank you so much.